Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 1st, 2010, and this is show number 271. Well, you've heard from my mother from time to time with her tech reviews, her own style of speaking, calling this the silly cast, mocking me at every opportunity. Well, today is her 90th birthday. We should all hope to be in such great shape as she is, walking and talking, taking yoga and getting herself downtown to go shopping, all while legally blind. But most importantly, to still be funny and clever and loving like she is. I love her dearly, and I'm delighted that she's still with us. She said she didn't think she was going to make it this far. I hoped. Next weekend, we're going to celebrate by taking her out on a boat for a champagne brunch in San Diego Harbor. That should be really fun because she likes champagne. All right, we're getting lots of happy birthdays here from the No Silla castaways. Yay! I love my mom. She's so cool. All right, should get going with the show, though. Well, our hosts for Steve and my podcasting tour of Europe are really outdoing themselves. Our plan is we're going to fly into London and descend on Don McAllister and his wife, Barbara. Oh, I made a mistake there. It's not London, actually. We're flying into Manchester and going to still bother Don and his wife, Barbara. He's scheduling the Liverpool tweet-up on August 24th at a location yet to be determined. Don created a reservation system, so if you're interested in attending that tweet-up, you can enter your name and email address, and you'll get notified when he's chosen a location and time. I put a link in the show notes to the reservation system, and if you're able to come, Steve and I would be delighted to meet you. Even if you don't want to meet us, you could always come just to meet Don, and then we'd get to meet you too. Well, next up, we dash over to Ireland, where Bart has arranged for us to stay on the gorgeous grounds of the University of Maynooth. I'm so excited about staying there. I put one of Bart's gorgeous photos of the grounds of the university. It's simply amazing. I've been looking at these pictures for all these years, and finally we're going to get to go there and stay at the university. Now, for the rest of you, Bart's plan for the tweet-up is to have a photo walk ahead of time at around 5 o'clock at night for whoever's interested. Finally, I'll get to learn from Bart in person. I plan on being a brilliant photographer by the time we go home, because I'll be learning for almost 2 straight hours. We hope to see the Matt Crack lads there for the photo walk at the very least, if not more of you. The Irish tweet-up will be on August 28th, and like I said, the photo walk's going to be at 5 o'clock and the tweet-up's going to be at 7 p.m. somewhere in Maynooth. Stay tuned for the exact location.
Warning. This program features an unusually high amount of Belgians. Belgians are known for their chocolate, their fries, their multilinguality, and their stylish good looks. If you, after prolonged exposure to Belgians, find people of other nationalities to be less interesting, intriguing, or attractive,
this is perfectly normal. So if you want to meet more Belgians, then make sure you come to Nosilicon 3, Belgium's biggest podcasting meet and greet, featuring the production team behind Nightwise.com's Nightcast and Steve and Allison from the NoSillaCast, and lots of Belgians. So beam on down on August 31st, Antwerp Central Station, Starbucks, starting at 1700 hours, NoSilicon 3.
Well, only Nightwise. You can see why we've got to go visit that guy. He's nuts. Well, he also gave us a poster for the show, and it's so beautiful. I think I'm going to actually make it my desktop background on my computer because it's just gorgeous. It's of Steve and I and Nightwise and Niana, and talks about No Silicon 3. Well, I got to tell you, a lot of people have been writing in generous offers to ferry us around while we're in Europe, but we've pretty much planned out every one of our days there, and we've set up these tweet-ups so we can still get to meet everyone we want to meet. I'm guessing that your heads are spinning with all these dates, and then there's the question about when the live show will be, and how about the anarchy on what time I'll record every Sunday? Is it 4:30? Is it 5? How is one to keep track? Well, luckily, I've cracked the code on that with the help of Connor P. and Katie Floyd. So, we've described the problem to be solved, and you know that Connor and I tried to make a Google Calendar ages ago, but it didn't seem to update properly when I made changes. Then on the Mac Roundtable, Katie Floyd tried the same thing, but luckily she's smarter than me. Here's the trick. I'm going to give you a URL, but you're not going to click on it. If you click on it, the NoSilicast calendar with all of the European tweet updates and the times for the weekly show will be there. But if I change anything, those dates will not update. What you need to do is copy the URL out of the show notes, and then in your calendar application, choose subscribe, subscribe to calendar, and then paste the URL in there. For some reason, that works perfectly, and you'll always know when the events are. Again, I put the URL in this week's show notes, but if you ever lose track of it, it's also on the NoSilicast live page over on podfeet.com. Remember, copy, don't click the URL. Well, Shai has become a regular in the NoSilla Castaways lineup for the live show, and this week he tweeted that he was freezing to death in line for the iPhone 4 in Australia. I asked if he'd care to share his experiences with us, and he agreed, and I'm really glad he did. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Hi, Alison. This is Shai here from Perth, Australia, and as you know, the iPhone 4 was released here last Friday, so I just wanted to tell you a little of my adventure in getting one. It all began on a dark and cold night. We have been awaiting the migration of the elusive iPhone 4 to Australian shores for months, waiting for the end of the month when they were scheduled to arrive on our land. 10 p.m., July 29th, 2010. I received a call from a fellow hunter saying that other hunters were seen around the nesting ground of the soon-to-be-arriving iPhone 4. We must make haste and grab our ground before we are forced too far back and thus miss our chance. For we heard rumours that only a few iPhones were to be migrating initially. So I layered on as much warmth as I could, grabbed some chairs and a sleeping bag, and headed towards the door. On my way out, my beautiful and very understanding fiancé was there to give me a parting kiss and wish me luck. On arrival to the nesting ground called the Apple Store on Hay Street, I joined my friend and introduced myself to my fellow hunters. As we had many hours of stakeout ahead, we all started chatting, and I made friends with the silent French guy, the chatty Spanish guy, the funny Singaporeans, and another awesome Aussie, who I spent many hours talking about all things Mac, photography, and Canon lenses. The stakeout was difficult as the temperatures started to drop. We huddled in our blankets as the air dropped to near freezing, 1.8 degrees Celsius, or for all those guys up north, 35 degrees Fahrenheit. We tried to sleep, but suddenly a piercing alarm was activated. We could barely hear each other talk through all the noise, and for an agonizing half an hour we contemplated how much did we really want an iPhone 4. But we persevered, and blissful silence came back close to midnight. Since we were wide awake now, we thought we'd gain some insight from other explorers who had suffered hardships during their adventures. So I opened my MacBook Pro, and we huddled around and watched the latest Star Trek movie. As the time came close to 8 a.m, the guardians of the iPhone made a dramatic appearance, full of celebration and cheers, hoping to bring some fun and merriment to the growing line of about 400 freezing souls. We were separated into two parties, one for long-term plans with various telephone companies, and the other for ones like myself, who wanted to own the precious outright. And finally, the doors burst open, and as I was one of the first there, I was allowed to approach. I was greeted with a sea of smiling faces, and I basked in the glow of LCD screens. The Apple Store staff were helpful and efficient, but were struck by the misfortune of uncooperative computers. Thankfully, my acquisition only took about 10 minutes, and I was able to take my prize into the world amid cheers and applause from all the Apple staff and many of my fellow hunters. On my arrival home, I nestled my new iPhone on a pillow and made plans on modifying my existing SIM card to fit the iPhone's new micro SIM slot. I printed out my plans, which I am sure Alison will put in the show notes, marked my SIM for surgery, and proceeded to cut. With some patience, a steady hand, my trusty scissors, and a nail file, I soon had my iPhone talking to the world. Then I had the wonderful idea of upgrading to OS 4.1. After the exciting wait of installation, I swiped my iPhone awake and was greeted with a message that said I had no SIM in the phone. Oh no. During the upgrade, for some unknown reason, my new iPhone decided not to recognize my SIM anymore. Time to contact my ever-present friend, Google, and find a solution. I reset my network settings. No luck. I reset all my settings. Still no luck. I took out the SIM, cleaned it multiple times, put it back in and out, then back in again, but to no avail. Now I started to worry, and decided as a last-ditch effort, I would resync my iPhone without a SIM card in, then put the SIM card back and reset all the settings. And it worked! Well, almost. Now the iPhone said that there was no service, but at least it acknowledged I had a SIM in it. I reset the network settings once again, and my carrier name popped onto the screen. Yay! So now I am a proud and very happy owner of a new and working iPhone 4. I am loving the Retina display immensely, as I do a lot of reading with the phone. And I have had no reception issues with it at all. Not even with the infamous death grip. Well, I hope you enjoyed my little adventure, and I must say a big thank you to Alison for bringing us such a fantastic podcast every week. So to Alison and all the Nocilla castaways, until next time, catch ya.
Well, Shai, that was certainly a harrowing tale. I've noticed that the horror of a 10-hour wait in line has finally faded for me as a distant memory, as though it happened to someone else. I hope you'll send us more recordings. That was absolutely fantastic. You could pretty much read the phone book to us, I think, and we'd love it. Well, as I mentioned before, and you're probably going to be sick of hearing about, we'll be jetting off on our Nocilla Castaway tour of Europe in a few weeks, and Katie Floyd, in a weak moment, has volunteered to run the show for me in our absence. Start thinking now about things you'd like to have review for her on the August 29th show so she doesn't have too much work to do. She says she's up for the idea of doing the show live, but wanted instructions on how I execute that complex maneuver of spinning all those plates at the same time. I thought I had documented it before, but I guess I dreamt that I did it. So I created a diagram of how my audio and video streams get into Ustream, and that kind of helps give you the overview. But for the step-by-step setup instructions, I reached for my trusty screen steps. With that, I can take screenshots every step of the way as I'm doing a mock recording, and then I can go back and type in the tricky instructional bits. When I'm done, I can make the live show lesson part of a bigger manual for the entire production process. Now, manuals are only available in the pro version of ScreenSteps, but since you get 25% off the purchase price with the coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, the pro version comes out only $60. Now, if you don't need to make manuals like I do, you could always go with the standard version, which only is $30 after the discount. In any case, by the time I leave, Katie will have a beautiful set of PDF instructions to guide you through the plate juggling involved in creating the NocillaCast. Hey, maybe it's time I do lucky episode 13 of Podcasting on Podcasting. I never did teach how to do a live show, and with a click of a button in ScreenSteps, I can make an HTML version that pipes directly into WordPress for the show notes. All right, let's hear next from good friend of the show, Jim Sewell, also known as Deverell on Twitter.
This is Jim, a.k.a. Deverell, from Key West. In celebration of the arrival of my first Mac USB microphone, I thought I'd do a review of a product that has really impressed me. I'm also using the product I'm reviewing to save the type version for the show notes and for my blog. More on that in a minute. The product I'd like to talk about is Mac Journal, written by Dan Schimpf and distributed by Mariner Software at marinersoftware.com. Mac Journal is a tool for journaling and blogging and brings together the utility of a nice editor, the tracking of a good organization system, the security of your little sister's diary stored in a bank lockbox, and the Mac goodness of simplicity by interfacing well with blogs and other systems automatically. There is a full 85-page manual included, which is also very well done, that covers all the details, so you can imagine there are too many features to cover completely in this format, but I'll hit the highlights. The latest version, version 5, has been rebuilt for Leopard and Snow Leopard and looks absolutely wonderful. No Windows or Mac Classic interfaces here. It's pure modern Mac style, complete with calendar, inspector, and other well-done panels to help create your masterpieces. It's nicer than TextEdit, but not as gaudy as Microsoft's Word. Just right for a tool you can use to get in and get out, but yet powerful enough you can produce your documents without ever leaving the program. Mac Journal handles every type of media: text files, PDFs, QuickTime movies, images, and you can even store files it doesn't recognize. You can record audio entries to your journal or blog, and it will even record video with your eyesight. You know, I said I'll post this on my blog? Well, I'm going to use this audio ability to include this recording, too, so the visually impaired don't have to rely on Alex to read it to them. He's a nice guy and all, but I thought it'd be a good use of the feature and give it a more personal touch. With Mac Journal, you create journals, which are like separate binders into which you place pages, or as they call them, entries. In my case, I have a journal for work-related information, one for ideas or future products, one for a course I'm taking, and one for each of the websites I run as WordPress blogs. Inside an entry, you can, of course, enter text either by typing or pasting, but you can also insert images and screen captures. Audio and video recording is done by using the recording bar interface, which is built into Mac Journal, and can be placed directly into an entry. Each entry you create has a title, date, tag, status, priority, rating, size, and content. Status has options to help you organize your entries, such as not started, underway, needs review, and completed, which makes it perfect for collaborative blogs or documents at your job. A common feature among better Mac programs is the ability to create smart journals or smart folders. Using this, you can combine any entries from all your journals into a single smart journal. Perhaps you want to be able to access all the entries about your new car in one place. Just tag the entries new car and create a smart journal. The companion feature to this is entry aliases, which are like file aliases in Mac OS X. They allow you to put a pointer to an entry in a different place. This is especially useful if your need doesn't warrant an extra smart folder, but just a pointer to another entry somewhere else. There is also a quick note window available that lets you press a shortcut and enter information into a compact note window without having to go back into the Mac Journal program. It's great for doing research in a browser and storing your findings without ever leaving your page. Mac Journal is not just some little kid's diary program either. It is a full-blown application with very good security, so it can be trusted with everything from corporate secrets down to the note you wrote to cute little red-haired girl you have a crush on. And only guys like the CIA can find out what you said. Hopefully they won't be that interested in your journal, though. The journals themselves can be locked with a password. You can store the password in your keychain if you like, but this is optional, as is the password hint. After locking a journal, you can click it again and choose to encrypt it. This uses AES-256 encryption, which the United States government says is good enough for everything up to top secret level documents. Of course, a tool like Mac Journal has the complete set of sorting and searching facilities. It's always easy to find the entry you're looking for, but the features never seem to end. If you insert an image into an entry, you can scale it right there to window width, 25, 50, or 75% with built-in tools. No need to leave the program to find your favorite graphics editor. This thing will even auto-discover wiki-like links to other entries. Just click a button and your internal linking is automatic if you like. Tables and lists? No problem, it does them too. Messy import? Mac Journal will automatically do a wide range of cleanups, such as removing email quotes, smiley faces, removing multiple spaces, removing HTML tags, and so on. It's got a ton of features for this. Do you wonder if you're overusing that new vocabulary building word you learned today? What about how many words you have in that term paper you're writing? The statistics panel will give you this and more in a single place. Of course, Growl support's built in. I love Growl because I set it to speak instead of popping up those little boxes. And I hear when a new mail comes in, and I can choose to ignore it if I'm busy since Growl announces who it's from and the subject. This and other features can be set in the extensive preferences choices you can use to modify Mac Journal to be the best for you. My favorite feature is the ability to update blogs. I have several websites that I run, and it's always a bit of a hassle to log in to blog, do the password thing, go to the posts, click add new. Nothing bad, but as I do several sites with several entries, it makes it time consuming. With Mac Journal, I just go to the journal that is linked to the website I want to add a post to. When I create an entry and get it just the way I want it, I just right click and select share. And one of the options is send to and then the name of my blog. And when I click, it's done. No logging in, no browser windows, nothing, just blogging goodness. This works with most of the popular blogs such as WordPress, LiveJournal, Blogger, TypePad, MovableType, and more. This is especially nice when you combine the ability to embed YouTube videos into an entry to the blog posting. You just put the video in your entry in Mac Journal, and when you post it, it goes with it. It's way better than using the blog interface. This program has built-in support for MobileMe, but I've found that by saving your journals into a Dropbox folder, you can access your journals from anywhere. Mariner Software has a great licensing policy. They allow you to install one serial number onto two Macs, but only if you're the only one using the product. This is great for me because I have my computer at work that only I use, and then my Mac at home. Dropbox makes for the perfect sync mechanism in my case. One final feature is the ability to export to podcasts, Microsoft Word, RTF, HTML, and many other formats. You'll never be trapped by a discontinued product, but I have a feeling that Mariner software isn't going anywhere for a long time based on the quality of Mac Journal. Mac Journal is available for iPad, iPhone, and Mac, and is available in 10 different languages. I've not tested it because I do not know what to look for, but the website says that Mac Journal is 100% accessibility supported, which is totally awesome and sets the standard for the rest of the developers out there that should be taking notes. Mac Journal is available from marinersoftware.com for $39.95. An upgrade is only $14.95, and they also have versions for the iPad and iPhone. Check it out. Mac Journal is a great software product, and I think you'll be happy that you did take a look. Mariner Software has other products too, so look around while you're there. Might find something else.
Wow, Jim, fantastic review. Mac Journal sounds really, really cool. You know, we're all always trying to struggle with how to organize notes and our thoughts and everything we're trying to do. And sometimes I think it's just the Holy Grail and we'll never get there. But I love your line that the security is worthy of love notes to the cute little red-haired girl. Awesome. So I also like the fact that it's got support for iOS devices, because now that's starting to be a requirement that I be able to do everything anywhere I am. And I'm delighted to hear that they're smart enough to make it accessible. Excellent review. Thanks for your help, Jim. And everybody's listening, all of this is in the show notes. So if you missed any of it, didn't pay enough attention, want to go back and read it, he did a good job of giving me the show notes too. Excellent. All right, next up, I've got a little promo I'd like to play for you from some friends of mine.
Do you have an iOS-equipped device? Do you want to learn how to do more with it? Are you looking for the best apps and looking for no-nonsense reviews and workflows? Well, then head on over to the App Obsessed podcast. Each week, Tom Perino, Matt Hillier, and Lola Wong pick a topic and review a handful of iOS applications and how they use them on a daily basis. The App Obsessed podcast can be found at appobsessed.postrus.com and in the iTunes podcast directory.
Well, these three folks are a lot of fun individually, so together I'm sure they've got a winning combination. Again, find the App Obsessed podcast at appobsessed.postrus.com. Took me a while to spell obsessed correctly. It's O-B-S-E-S-S-E-D. Anyway, I bet you probably spell better than I do. So you probably didn't have any problem with that, but I'm going to listen in.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Gabby writes in, "Hi, Allison. I have a question that I think counts as a dumb question. See what you think. Before I get there, I just want to relay a quick story. I got into podcasts many years ago through the iTunes store by doing a search for Mac. I got Adam's MacCast and a few others. Anyway, the NoSillaCast was nowhere on the list, but I kept hearing this Allison person on Tim's SurfBits podcast who would always end with a plug for her NoSillaCast podcast. I ignored that plug for a good while, but one week I was running low on podcasts, holiday weekend, so I figured what the heck. Might as well give it a shot. Her reviews are witty and insightful. So I did. Needless to say, years later, I have stayed subscribed and very much enjoy your work. I even listen to it on Mondays before Twit. Don't tell Leo. All that is to say how much I and many others enjoy and appreciate the time and effort. Well, thanks so much, Gabby. I'm glad you did find the show finally. And it reinforces why I changed my podcast name in iTunes to NoSillaCast Mac Podcast. I'd heard that I didn't come in on any Mac searches. Of course, I named my show purposely vague so that I could talk about anything I wanted to talk about, but that's been kind of a blessing and a curse. I added Mac to the name so people would find me for what I primarily blather about, but I do retain the right to say nice things about Windows 7 from time to time. I'm never going to say anything nice about Windows Vista XP, just so you know. Anyway, back to the question, battery management. What is the right way to take care of a laptop battery? I have an almost 3-year-old MacBook Pro, and I've gone through 2 batteries so far. I have a 6-year-old G4 on its original battery. Why the difference? I never turn either off. I close the lid and sleep it. I do carry them to work often. I generally keep them plugged in when I can. I've looked in the internet and I get everything from plug it in and keep it plugged in to let it cycle all the time. I've tried the let it go all the way down to nothing and then charge it back up to cycle it method. Anyway, I'm a bit tired of buying my yearly battery, especially when they both had far less than 100 cycles. The Apple Genius said to let it run down often, but that just seems to me to mean more cycles more rapidly, and all the knowledge-based stuff says I have 300 cycles plus, so I'm eager not to get to 300 or so quickly. Anyway, any thoughts are appreciated, and as always, keep up the great work, Gabby. Well, Gabby, about your question, I can't answer it. You'd think this would be a dumb question, but it's not. The geekiest of the geeks I know are John F. Braun and Dave Hamilton of the Mac Geek Gab, so I went directly to their site to see if they'd ever come up with a definitive answer. I remember recently them talking about it and discussing all the different ways you could mess with your battery to try to keep it healthy, but I wasn't sure I could remember the exact answer, so I went over and checked it out. What I found on the MacObserver.com website, and I have the specific link in the show notes, was a survey. With a very small and limited sample set, they first said, keeping your battery on charge most of the time seems to result in less than 50% of the original capacity after about 1 year, even if you cycle it regularly. Beating the heck out of your battery, i.e. half charging, killing, half draining, charging, and simply being erratic with it, seems to result in maintaining or even increasing battery capacity over many years. Now, John and Dave decided that was not a good answer if their sample set was so small. So they created a survey to gather specific information from other users to try and draw a pattern. That's how hard the answer is to this one. I went through the survey on my own machine, hoping at the end to be rewarded with a compilation of the survey results so far, but John F. Braun is such a tease. All he says at the end is, thanks, I'll put it in my spreadsheet. Come on, John! Anyway, I sent him a tweet and I haven't heard back from him yet, but I want to see that spreadsheet. Let's see some results here. So anyway, if the Mac Geek app doesn't know the answer, I'm afraid you might be disqualified officially from Dumb Question Corner. Or maybe it does qualify, because technically, it's supposed to be a question that you figure everyone else knows the answer to, right? Just because they don't know the answer doesn't mean it's not a dumb question by that specific category. So I think I'm going to have to officially make this a dumb question, but there is no dumb answer to the dumb question. Anyway, thanks for sending this one in, Gabby. Remember last week when I told you about how Honda Bob put these giant air horns under his car? Well, this week, he's driving down the highway and he sees some guy weaving back and forth. He figured the guy must be drunk. Bob pulls up beside him and discovers that it's actually as bad as if he were drunk. He was texting while driving. Bob could not resist. He gave a long blast on those air horns, and the guy jumped so high out of his seat that he dropped his phone. Now, Bob personally thought this was hilarious, but I think he did a public service for everyone else on the highway that day. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, friend of the show, Dean Elger, gave me some audio that seems like a perfect segue into Chit Chat Across the Pond and Security Light.
Hey, Allison, cell phone. This is Dean, the human being. And I know this is so last week to actually call you rather than tweet you, email. Well, you wouldn't email either, probably text you, whatever. But I am now, it is July 30th, and I just listened to your July 18th show. I was behind. Three things I noticed. One is, yes, you are a huge burden on the Elger pocketbook, and you did mention that in there. The second thing is you should never listen to Security Light 2 weeks after you do it because it scares the hell out of you, and you freak out and realize, oh, my God, for 2 weeks I've been dealing with this thing that I didn't go fix. And the last thing is that I cursed you when I downloaded, because I actually take your shows and put them on CDs to be able to listen to them in my old Mercedes. But I actually cursed you when I made the two CDs. And then, sure enough, at the end of the show, you say, I hope you're stuck in lousy traffic. And I am stuck in lousy traffic trying to get to Milwaukee on a Friday afternoon for a 2:30 meeting. It'll be over at 3 and then put me in 3 hours of nasty traffic again. Anyway, there I ranted. I can't really do that as well in text. Talk to you later. Bye.
Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart B. I did it again. With Bart Bouchotz from BartB.ie. How are you today, BartB.ie?
I'm good. Maybe if you say the same thing too often, it gets harder.
I think so. It's like when you repeat a word and it starts to sound funny after a while.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a huge show, a big, big show today. So let's kick right into Security Light and see what's going on.
Okay, so first off, we have an update from, I think it was last week, we talked about the horrible, evil, scary Microsoft Link bug and how it was going to be a big one.
Yeah.
Well, it is becoming a big one. It's now being actively attacked, which is not surprising because this thing is amazing for attackers. And also, apparently now, even stuff like the favicons in IE can be used to trigger it even. So it's really become a serious thing.
Yeah.
If you're interested in all about its wonderfulness, Security Now did an episode where they spend a lot of time talking about, which is number 258. So rather than me just repeat what they said, if you're interested, have a listen to Steve and Leo talk about it.
Excruciating detail?
Yeah, well, not that excruciating because we don't really know, we don't have the actual attack code. So it's just stuff coming out and what people are saying and what people are reporting and being able to do with it. So it's not the usual level of make your head explode. It's just sort of make your jaw hit the floor and say, oh my God, this is bad.
Great.
But we have good news. This is Security Light. And we need to give a thank you out to Steve, who was the first one to spot this and send it out into the Tweeterverse. Is that a new word?
Tweetyverse? Tweeterverse?
Tweeterverse. I don't know what you're calling.
Twittersphere.
But Microsoft are, probably not unsurprisingly, issuing an out-of-band patch for this doozy of a bug, which will hit our virtual store shelves on Monday, probably Monday American time. So those of us in Europe should probably update in the evening. But everyone who has a Windows machine should update this ASAP. This is a really big one, and I imagine there's going to be worms attacking this forever. So patch, patch, patch.
Okie dokie. I'm going to send myself an email while we're talking about this.
It's a little reminder in your iCal, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, that's good news. Glad they're patching it.
Yes, thank goodness they are, because this really is a doozy. Apple are also doing some patching, not to the same level of oh my god-ery, but we have a new version of Safari, which is 5.0.1 for those of us on Snow Leopard, and 4.1.1 for people who can't run 5 because they're on Tiger or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Or they haven't updated, whatever. So it's 5.0.1 and 4.1.1, and they're cross-platform updates. So usual security fixes. The 5.0.11 is interesting for a whole other reason. It introduces Safari extensions and the extensions gallery.
Oh, so you get fries with that.
You get fries with that. So in 5.0, we could run extensions, but you had to go find them yourself. Now we have the gallery, and now the extension support is official.
Okay, I was trying to figure out what was going on. I thought, well, wait a minute. I remember we got extensions like a month ago. Why is everybody all excited? But it's because they have extensions to in a library now for us?
Yes. And initially, the 5.0 was meant for developers so that they could start developing extensions. Now, Apple are really saying, okay, extensions have really arrived now. Here's a gallery of all the ones that we've curated. So it's a bit like the iTunes or the iTunes App Store. They check these things to make sure that they're safe.
Excellent.
So it's a walled garden, but it's an optional walled garden because you can install any plugin. But you can still go shopping safely in Apple's gallery.
Excellent. While we were talking, right as you were saying that, I noticed a pop-up out of the left-hand corner of my eye, and I looked over, and it was the update for Safari 5.0.1.
It's funny you say that, because just as your Skype rang for me, the same happened to me.
I didn't choose to do it during Security Light, though.
No, being Safari, it's almost certainly going to require a reboot. In fact, it does. There's a little play icon that says it needs a reboot. So definitely don't want to do it now.
You know, there was a period where everything made a reboot, and lately they've been slacking on that because my machine was just getting really nasty. And I did an uptime request in the terminal, and it said it had been 21 days.
Mm.
That's too long for me.
Maybe too long for OS X as well.
Right, right. All right, okay. Anything else?
Yes. So we said that the walled garden was all good and safe. Well, the walled garden isn't perfect. There was a problem with Citibank's iPhone app. It basically left sensitive information in an unencrypted file, which is bad in the sense that if someone got your iPhone and plugged it into a Linux machine and started poking around in the file system, they could pull out the unencrypted data, which gave access to your bank. That takes a bit of skill. It was worse because that same data would be inside the iPhone backup on your desktop machine.
Okay.
So malware could simply read it out from there. They have fixed the update by encrypting that file. So if you use the Citibank iPhone app, there will be an update waiting for you in iTunes. Do it.
Okay.
And that's really all there is to say about it. They made a boo-boo. They fixed it. Fix yourself.
Okay. That one got downloaded by a gazillion people, as I recall. That was a fairly big deal.
Yeah, I have no idea how good or bad it is because we don't have Citibank over here. So it's not one I can play with.
Okay. All right. Well, we've eaten our vegetables now. Can we move on to the fun part?
Yes. And I had a lot of fun writing this.
I'm real excited. I got to read ahead, everyone. So I know what he's going to talk about. It's way cool.
Yes. Now, this is one where you're going to want to read along in the show notes as we go because there's examples and stuff. So that makes it all a bit clearer, because it's hard to talk about photography sometimes. But my logic here was that it would be nice to talk about photography and not to get technical at all.
So we're not going to talk about f-stops or light metering or anything like
that? No f-stops, no light metering, no camera makes and models, no discussion of different sensors.
A little bit of math. There's fractions.
Well, okay, one fraction. Just one.
Okay.
Not a hard one. So what I thought we would talk about is composition. I think that the single biggest divider between a nice photo and a snapshot is composition. If you have a really nice camera, you can get your fancy thin depth of field, which all adds up to making the photo look a little more professional. But if it's not well composed, even that won't help. And even if you can't do the fancy shallow depth of field, if you get nice compositions, your photos will still look not like snapshots. They will look infinitely better just by changing how you compose things and thinking more about it. So I think it's probably the single most fruitful thing you can put some time and effort into is just learning a little more about the theory of composition and practicing and trying to get a little more out of your photographs that way.
Okay.
The most important thing to say here is that there is no such thing as, a list of five absolute rules, and if you follow these rules, absolutely, you will absolutely have the world's best photographs. Because that's just not how photography works. It's an art.
You're no fun.
It's not a science, it's an art. Well, okay, some bits of it are science, as in making the camera go, but the actual photography is an art. So what we have are guidelines and things to think about and tips and tricks and little things to help you, but ultimately, none of these are hard and fast rules. Each and every one of them can and should be broken from time to time, and they're here to help you, not to constrain you. So don't feel that you absolutely positively have to do all of this. If you see a really nice composition that doesn't follow the rules, so what? Do it.
So this is back to what you keep always telling us, that Ansel Adams wasn't amazing because of what camera he used?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no. Obviously, he was a master of his camera, and I'm sure you could have given him a point and shoot, and he would have gone out and taken amazing photos.
Right. I mean, you look at what Robert Lachman does with an iPhone, and you realize the difference between the snapshot and him.
Yeah, because it really isn't so much the tool as what you do with it. Mm-hmm. So I guess the one rule, if you want to talk in terms of absolute rules, is that there are no rules.
Okay.
And in fact, intelligently breaking the rules can be very effective. So everything we're going to talk about today is about trying to get photographs that are pleasing to the eye, that are harmonious, that just sit comfortably and nicely within the frame. If your intention is to go out and make photographs that make people feel uncomfortable, that convey tension, that convey any other sort of thing other than comfort, intentionally breaking all of these rules will give you exactly what you want.
Okay.
So with all that in mind, I don't want this to be a prescription. I just want this to be a help. So bear these things in mind and help it guide your creativity, but don't feel constrained, because that would be terrible.
Okay.
So the first and simplest rule is don't stick the subject in the middle of the photo. It's probably everyone's default reflex. You want to take a photo of this bird, you put the bird in the middle and you hit the shutter. You want to take a picture of this baby, you put the baby in the middle and you hit the shutter. You want to take a picture of this flower, you put the flower in the middle and you hit the shutter. That gives boring photos. pretty much never a good idea, with, as always, a caveat. And that caveat is that if you have something which is just oozing symmetry all over the place, stick it right smack bang in the middle. If you really want to hammer home that symmetry, if it's circular or square, give it a square crop as well, and then you can really use the symmetry. But in general, a central composition isn't good unless you're doing it intentionally for a reason like that. So the first example I have, is just to prove that these rules aren't really rules, is a photograph of a rose taken face on, dead center, cropped to a square.
Now, I'm looking at that, and it is perfect. I mean, that really does draw the eye dead center. Everything is symmetrical. I think a rectangular crop would look goofy on that. It wouldn't have come out quite as nicely.
No, it wouldn't, actually.
I do see, I started flipping through the photos. I considered 5-star photos of mine, and a lot of times, maybe it's just my emotional attachment to the people, but there'll be a picture of like Steve and I as two people, and it's just a picture of us. It's not about the background or anything like that. And so we're centered, and that looks good to me.
Yeah, there are exceptions. If the person is staring straight into the camera, then you can often get away with it dead center. But if the person is looking even the slightest bit to the left or the slightest bit to the right, you need to compensate for that by shoving them off center in the opposite direction.
Ah, that's one of my favorite things you wrote about in here. That's going to be interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So as I say, the first thing is don't put them in the middle. So the next question is, well, where do you put them then? If you don't put it in the middle, where next? And probably the most important thing it's the most common mistake I see. If it has eyes, then give it room to look into. Even if it doesn't have actual eyes, but if it's just sort of anthropomorphically has a face, give it room to look into. That means flowers, that means insects, that means birds, dogs, people, everything. Give it room to look into. So if you have a person looking to the left and you put them in the very middle of the frame, it will feel awkward because their gaze adds sort of weight to the photograph. So you need to counterbalance that by moving them a little to the left. So there should always be less room between the back of someone's head and the frame and the front of someone's head and the frame. And it doesn't just go for people. That goes for butterflies. It goes for everything. So you'll see that the example I've included here is a photo of a butterfly, and he's sitting edge on to us. So he's looking to the right. And on the left edge, the back of his wings is very close to the edge of the frame. Whereas on the right side, his face is a long way from the other edge. And that gives a comfortable, balanced composition.
I would have never thought of that, Bart. That never occurred to me before, but as I looked at you've got a couple of examples, including the butterfly, and it just works. That room to move into, to look into.
You need room to look into, because if you imagine that shot with the frame closer to the butterfly's face, if you just cover a bit of it up with your hand, it won't feel right, because it'll feel cramped, because there's nowhere for the animal to see. So it feels like someone's put an artificial sort of cut there. It's not a natural place to cut where someone's looking.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all about naturalness and having stuff fit into the frame and not feel like the frame sliced off something interesting.
Now, is this something you just figured out looking at photos, looking at this one looks good, this one looks bad, what's the difference between the two, and why does one make me feel better and the other one makes me uncomfortable?
Oh, goodness no, I can't take credit for any of these things. These are all bits and pieces that I've picked up.
Okay.
From lots of different people, because I love reading about photography. I love looking at photos. I love listening to photography podcasts. So these are just bits and pieces I've picked up from all over the place.
Okay.
Put together. I couldn't possibly tell you who taught me what, but the world taught me all of these things. As important as it is to give stuff room to look into, and that is exceptionally important, you can double that importance if the object is moving. A moving car, a moving bicycle, a walking person, a flying bird, a running dog, train, anything that is moving needs twice as much space to move into. Because it's going to be looking the direction it's moving, and it's moving in that direction. So it feels twice as uncomfortable if you take a photo of a train and you crop it off right at the nose of the train. It just doesn't work. And a moving car needs a fair bit of room to feel natural in a frame, or, you know, a running dog or whatever. So the rule is important for anything that looks, but it's twice as important for something that moves. So again, the example below, shock and or horror, because it's me, it's a train.
But yeah, I definitely see what you're talking about with the movement, that you can see where it's going, that if it were cropped off in the front where the train is trying to go, it wouldn't
feel
work.
Like it would feel like it's going to run into the edge of the photograph.
Right, right.
Which makes it uncomfortable. So that is, without a shadow of a doubt, the one thing I see done wrong the most often. I'm a member of a lot of train photography groups on Flickr, and a lot of nature photography groups on Flickr. And the difference between the photos that make you go, wow, and the photos that make you go, potential, but are no room to move or look into. The single biggest mistake I see anywhere I go. Then probably the most famous rule that everyone talks about when they talk about composition is the rule of thirds.
Right.
So I figure we definitely need to cover that, because that is the one rule that if anyone knows only one thing about composition, they know the rule of thirds.
I know it. Whether I remember to follow it is a good point. But
sure, but you don't have to follow it. It just, it's one of those things that can make for really strong compositions. So your rule of thirds, you have to imagine a grid over your photograph. And in fact, an awful lot of editing software will give you this grid. And even some cameras will actually allow you to overlay the grid on the screen on the back of the camera or even on the viewfinder sometimes.
Right.
Now,
I've
our camera
that.
Doesn't.
Yeah, I've seen some that. And some do. Of the point-and-shoots actually will do that for you.
Yeah. So in order to get the grid, you just imagine a line one-third of the way down from the top of the photograph horizontally, one-third up from the bottom of the photograph horizontally, then a vertical line one-third in from the left, and another one one-third in from the right. And that gives you 9 rectangles. If the photograph is square, they're 9 squares, but in general, they're 9 rectangles.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff feels good if it runs along one of the lines, or if it's an object, if it's sitting at one of the crossroads.
Oh,
so either of those
okay.
two things works well. So if you have something vertical or horizontal in the shot, if you have it approximately along one of the lines of thirds, that will feel natural. And if you need to place your main subject somewhere that they're going to have a strong presence in the photograph, stick it on one of the 4 crossroads.
Okay. I always thought the object had to be in one of the thirds. No, I didn't catch it was supposed to be on the crossroad of it.
The crossroads are really important places. And for anything straight, the lines are fantastic places. So in this case, the first example I have is a butterfly shot. And in this case, the butterfly is at the lower third corner. And it's sitting there. And then it's looking into the rest of the shot. And that works on the two levels. A, he's approximately on one of the rule of thirds points. And B, he's got lots of room to look into. So it works twice.
There's actually a daisy or something in the background that's got a black center that's also on a third.
It's on the counterbalancing third, actually, which helps too. Yeah.
Right, right.
And that leads into another point we'll talk about later, that our brain is fascinated with diagonals.
I was going to say,
so if you can put something on the two rule of third, on two opposing rule of third points, then that gives you your diagonal and that helps even more.
Right, right.
Then the example below that is using a vertical line. In this case, it's a photograph of a bird with a very long neck. They're called herons and they love fishing. You often see them sitting along the canal and stuff in Ireland. So he's got a big long vertical neck. So you put the vertical neck along the rule of thirds line. And in this case, he has a head too. So actually, put
eyes.
The head on the crossroads.
Oh, okay. Right, right, right.
So then you win twice there.
And he has room to look into.
Exactly. Because you've moved him over onto one of the rule of thirds lines, you've given him two-thirds of the photograph to look into. Now, if you'd stuck him on the other rule of thirds line, you would have had a horrifically bad photograph. Because his beak would have been touching the frame.
Right, right, right. It wouldn't have worked at all.
Would not have worked at all. So that's a good example there of using the rule of thirds doubly so, and again, room to look into.
So isn't it hard to always compose the photo this way, though, when your brain is saying, look at that bird? My brain would try to focus right on the bird.
Now, in our case, because our cameras only have a single autofocus point, I would use the central autofocus point, autofocus on the bird's eye, and then crop in post. Don't be afraid to crop.
Okay.
I've purposely chosen photographs in these examples, actually, that have been cropped, because I don't believe you should be constrained to the one aspect ratio your camera happens to be made to.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, that's 2x3 or 6x4. But some cameras are 3x4. Some things just look better square. So crop to a square. Some things look better in a panoramic aspect ratio. So crop to a panorama. Crop to something that's comfortable. Don't feel you have to make it the same shape the camera was. And don't be afraid to throw away bits of the photograph. If you can do a crop that will improve the composition, do the crop. Okay, you've lost a few pixels, but so what? You got a much nicer photograph for it.
So my daughter Lindsay has a great eye in photography, even with a point and shoot. And one of the things I've noticed she'll do on occasion is she'll take a photo and crop it real long and thin, like a giant panorama. And it's really effective. And my brain still thinks I'm going to print prints. But even though I haven't printed in 3 years, but my brain still goes, no, it must always crop 2x3. I've done it on occasion, but it's like really hard to get myself to do it.
I slowly weaned myself off that. At first I was the same. So then I went, okay, but I'm choosing to print these digitally. So I can also say I want some of them 3x2.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and then another common aspect ratio would be an 8x10. And I just started using the common aspect ratios. And then at one point, they just went, oh, sod that, I'll just crop it any way I want.
Well, and the other thing is, since we're using aperture, it's non-destructive, right? So we could go back and get it if we just, you know, on some bizarre occasion decided to use paper to print.
Or we could just right-click duplicate version and then adjust the crop so that it fits one of the magic print sizes.
Right. It could happen.
Or we can print it with bars. I mean, if you're going to frame something in a neutral glass frame, it can have a white band above or below.
Ooh, that's crazy talk, Bart.
Well, I don't think so, because just because the frame is that shape doesn't mean the photo has to be.
That's true.
So really, don't be afraid to crop. One last thing, actually, that's on the rule of thirds. Another very common place to use the rule of thirds is to place your horizon on it. That's a strong horizontal feature. So if you want to get lots of sky, a big imposing sky over a landscape, stick the horizon on the lower third. And that'll give you a big dramatic sky. So if you obviously need to have something interesting up there. A pure blue Californian sky, probably not your best bet there.
Yeah, since we don't have many clouds, we don't get those great shots sometimes.
Yeah. In Ireland, where we always have fluffy clouds, the question is whether or not there's any blue between the fluff. That can work very well. Or the other, if you want to draw the attention to the land, you move it the other way so you get lots of land and just a third of horizon.
I think that's probably the most classic mistake I see, and people say, wow, look at this great sunset shot I got or something, and it's got the horizon directly dead center. It's like,
I was going to come to that later, but actually now's a good time to mention it. It's the second most common mistake. Stick the subject in the middle and stick the horizon in the middle. The horizon in the middle works amazingly well in a few subsets, but majority of the time, it's not good. You don't have to be as extreme as sticking it right to the rule of thirds. So even just a little off-center by going, say, halfway up to the rule of thirds is fine most of the time. A rule of thirds will give you a strong composition, but it may not fit with the rest of your photo. But definitely try to avoid it being dead center with one giant mega caveat. If you're taking a photograph of reflections, do everything you can to get that horizon dead center.
Oh, because that puts things probably a third above and a third below.
Just that. It also does that sort of magic thing where your brain is going, which of these is the real world? And with the reflection, that's what you're going for. You have the two worlds. And so if you imagine you're standing at a lake and there's a mountain in the background reflected in the lake, if you just pop that horizon dead center, you'll have the mountain twice.
Right.
And that will be a powerful shot.
I'm going to interrupt you right here. I just put a link in the Skype chat there. I have a photo I want you to look at. Steve Stanger of the Mac Attack sent a link over to a set of photos, beach photos, where two of his were featured. And I was looking at those, and there's a photo that I just love this photo because it hasn't obeyed any of the rules. So I'm going to reinforce what you said about none of the rules. First of all, about 95% of the photo is sky. It's got this sliver of beach with a tiny, tiny little sliver of ocean in the background. There's a boat dead center on that. But then on the right-hand side, not on a third, on like maybe 20% of the photo, is a woman bending over and her head is cut off and she's doing something outside of the frame. She hasn't got room to look into. Her head is cut off. There's no rule of thirds. The boat is centered and it's a fantastic photograph.
Yeah, it has a strange sense of tension, though, and a strange sense of unnaturalness, because it's called Attack of the 500-Foot Woman.
Yeah, I don't like the title, though. I mean, I didn't think of the 500-Foot Woman, but...
Look at the boat.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just thought it was... I found myself wondering, what's she doing in the back on the right-hand side? Is she feeding a child? What is she doing? Is she spending over doing something for someone? But you're right. It definitely is a tension photo. It's not a happy little composition. But I really like it.
Which is why it's very powerful, because it intentionally breaks the rules.
Yeah.
So knowing the rules allows you to intentionally break them, and intentionally breaking them can be every bit as powerful as intentionally following them.
Yeah.
So all of these rules, I guess, have an inverse that has the opposite effect. And if you want the opposite effect, do the opposite.
Exactly.
So that's pretty much all we can say on the rule of thirds. Then we've already sort of mentioned cropping. I'm a huge fan of panoramic crops to give more of a sense of speed to things that are moving across a frame, because it really draws the eye into that horizontal motion. So an example I have there is of a train speeding by, and it's very extremely cropped to be very wide and not very tall at all. And it's running straight out of the shot, and it really drags the eye along with the train, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah. I do like the cropping on that. I think a rectangular 4x3 crop would not have been as interesting.
It would have been a nice shot, but it would have been a very plain shot.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's kind of what you're poking at is cool versus plain.
Yeah, compelling. And interesting. Give your eye something to enjoy.
Yeah.
So another thing that we've already touched on is diagonals. We just love them. So find them everywhere you can, and whenever you find one, use one. And they can come from all sorts of places. One of my favorite shots, I didn't actually include it here because I already have a different example of diagonal. But if you have, imagine a butterfly sitting on a flower, and if you just turn yourself so that the butterfly's wings bisect the frame, so you have half of your rectangular shot is butterfly and the other half isn't. You just put them on the diagonal like that. That can work very strongly.
You know, right after somebody had told me about the diagonal thing, I was, I think we were hiking and we found there was a beautiful mountain in the background. And I noticed if I ran forward into the brush, there was a fence that was making a nice diagonal. And I threw that in. It really made a big difference.
Yes. Or if you want to take a picture, say, of a flower, and it's a long, tall flower, and you can't really put it off center because it won't look just right. If you just tilt it even slightly so that the flower is coming in from the bottom corner, that can work, just to add a bit of interest. Just have the flower diagonally running through a very tall, narrow crop.
Oh, that's interesting.
But in this case, the example I have is, again, a butterfly. And he's sitting on a little twig, and the twig is moving away, is jutting away from us, but it's cutting through the frame at the diagonal, and then at the tip of the twig is the butterfly looking along the diagonal, so you get sort of a double effect of the diagonal, because the plant is one diagonal, the butterfly's gaze gives you the reverse diagonal, and of course, he's up close, he's on a rule of thirds point, and he's lots of room to look into. So you have a diagonal, rule of thirds, and lots of room to look into. So that composition uses a lot of the guidelines.
And it's a cool-looking twig. It's a flower.
It's actually a flower that's not open yet.
It's a whole bunch of little tiny buds. They're really pretty. So yeah, you won on every front on that one.
I was very lucky. I nearly stepped on that butterfly. He's unbelievably tiny.
Oh.
And I was just thinking, I'm never going to get a photograph of these teeny tiny little ones I've read about. And then I looked, oh, look, there's a red thing I'm about to step on. Oh my God, it's one of those butterflies.
Oh, so he's and way down low on the ground?
He's way down low, and so was I.
Oh, wow. I'm looking forward to seeing you crawling on the ground doing your photography.
Oh, I get dirty legs on my trousers all the time when I'm out photographing. Gotta get low on the ground sometimes. Only way to get your good shots.
All right.
So all of this so far is sort of very abstract shapes and things. Probably one of the other big challenges in composition is dealing with the annoying reality that we live in a three-dimensional world and we want to capture three-dimensional things. And our eyes are great for that, having two of them to give us stereo vision. However, the camera is a great big cyclops. And that has the effect of collapsing depth.
Mm.
Gets rid of all of that sense of depth. And so you have to carefully put that sense of depth back through very carefully choosing your compositions. And before we even get to that, I want to take some time. It's not strictly compositional, but it's just a reminder to check for two things every time you take a photograph of a place. Be careful of what are called mergers. You, with your eye, will not notice the tree straight behind the person because your brain will tell you that tree's miles away. However, once you take the photograph, it will look like it's growing on their head.
I hate it when that happens. We have this fabulous picture of Steve and Lindsay and Kyle and I all dressed up real nice to go out to dinner. We're down in Cancun, and we just look like a million bucks, and there's a giant pot growing out of the top of Lindsay's head.
Yeah, exactly. Or a stop sign or something. It can happen very easily because our eyes see in three dimensions, we have to train ourselves to notice these things because it's not something we naturally notice. So keep an eye out for mergers. And the other thing are what we call intruders. we tend to focus on what's in what our subject is. So the butterfly, the flower, the beautiful building, the lovely landscape. And we don't always notice that there's a stupid branch poking into the left of the frame or the top of the frame, or that we've just caught the very edge of a stop sign ruining the top left corner of the shot or whatever. So be careful just before you hit the shutter. I'm into the habit now, just before hitting the shutter, I look up, down, left, and right to make sure that there's nothing silly happening at the margins, and then hit the shutter.
You know, somebody told me once, if you look at indoor photography, count the number of photos you find that have an outlet or a power port in them.
Or even worse, a bisected outlet or power port.
My friend,
because that will draw your eye to it.
My friend John Zellner is a really, really interesting artist. He draws these bizarre little creatures like you've never seen before, and they're often doing odd, entertaining things. And he has this one of this weird little creature, and he's sitting on a little pillow. It's a pencil sketch. He's sitting on a little pillow on a little stool, and there's a picture frame behind him and an outlet in the corner. He put it in the photo, in the sketch on purpose.
Sketch, yeah.
Yeah, he did it manually. Cool. Yeah, it was perfect.
Drawing attention to the common whoopsies. Yeah, so definitely be careful of what's in the edges of your frame, because you won't notice it while you're taking the picture, but the moment you print out the picture or you stick it up on your screen, you're going, oh shoot, that's horribly distracting. And you can clone it out, but better not to get it in.
Right.
Yeah, because you know, you can do a lot with cloning, but it's a lot of work and some things you really can't get away with.
I said that's a good one. But that's a good one. I'm going to try.
It's a habit to learn to teach yourself. You know, don't just click the shutter. Stop, think. And I usually go through a few little checklists in my head, but one of the important ones is check the corners.
That's good to know that it doesn't come naturally. I feel a little bit better that I'm not, you know, just a dork, that our brains don't naturally see it. Like you said, that you have to say, okay, now look and see, what is the camera going to notice?
Yeah, exactly. It's a different way of thinking. We think bifocally. Not bifocally, binocular vision-wise.
Right.
And the camera doesn't. It's a big cyclops. So you have to train your brain to think like that. And it does not come natural. If you do it long enough, it becomes a reflex. That before I click, I just check. But it's never natural. If that makes sense.
Right.
So now let's get into actually composing our landscape shots. Or not just landscapes, because I didn't really want to use the word landscape. This counts for cityscapes or just photographs of gardens, of buildings. Photographs of places
okay.
is probably a much better term than to say landscapes, because then people think it's only for these grand Ansel Adams things. This applies throughout the board for photographs of places. We have to put back that sense of depth, because when we're in a beautiful garden, we feel it as a three-dimensional space, and that adds to its beauty. And then we take a picture and we're almost always going to go, oh no, that wasn't what it looked like. That was a 16th century castle. It didn't look like that. It was so much nicer. And the reason is because we've lost all the depth. So the key here is layers. You want three. You want something interesting at three different layers. Think of it as an interesting foreground, an interesting middle ground, and an interesting background. If you can get more layers, great, but at least three. There's no such thing as too many layers. If you've ever seen a photograph taken in a mountain range where you might have six layers of mountains going off into the background, it can be stunningly beautiful. But think of three.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the landscape itself is your middle layer, or the house, or the 16th century castle, or the main part of the garden. So you tend to get the middle layer for free.
Okay.
That's what you would have got on your flat photograph. A lot of the time you get the background one for free too, if you're lucky enough to live in somewhere that has good skies. Unfortunately, that doesn't help you very much. You're going to have to work a little harder.
We had clouds a couple weeks ago. It does happen.
You should look at it as an opportunity, actually, because if you want to do any sort of landscape work or any sort of outside photography, having nice clouds in the background makes it all so much easier. Because that gives you your background layer for free, too. You've now got two free layers. And so the only thing you have to worry your little head about is finding the third. And generally speaking, you've got to have something of interest in the foreground. That's what really makes the shot suddenly get that sense of depth. So I've given an example here. The first example I've given is one of my favorite landscape shots I've ever taken. I'm actually going to print this one out. I love it so much. And I don't do the printing thing. I'm going to have white borders on it because it's cropped like mad into a great big long panorama. But you have a tree in the foreground. You have the actual landscape in the midground. Then you have a castle in the distant background. And to top it all off, one of those spectacular Irish skies.
Right.
So you've four layers there. And that So you really get a sense of depth because the tree pulls you in, the castle pushes you back. So it really feels like a three-dimensional world you're looking into.
Now, you chose to do that in grayscale.
I did. I also have a color version of it, but I thought the grayscale made the sky look cooler.
I know this isn't in your list of things, but why is that? Why? I've been flipping through photographs while we've been talking, and very frequently the picture that really grabs me is the grayscale one. It can be people, it can be castles, it can be trees, it can be skies.
Texture. Grayscale really helps texture sing a lot of the time.
Hmm.
And it can also add a lot of drama, because in this case, by using the channel mixer, I turned blue to black. So it's clearly daytime, and yet you have this dark, deep black sky. That adds a lot of drama to a shot.
Yeah.
Ansel Adams was the master of that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, I took a picture, I did an HDR photograph of Tom Sawyer's Island at Disneyland, and I was really, really pleased with it on the iPhone when I did it, and I thought, oh, wow, that's really cool. And then a couple of days later, I looked at it, and I noticed that I could pull the saturation out, and I turned it into grayscale, and I went, it was like 10 times cooler. Now the other one just looks stupid. It doesn't even look good to me now.
Well, HDR brings out texture, and the monochrome brings out texture. So monochrome HDRs really bring out texture. In fact, the example here is a monochrome HDR.
Is it? Okay.
It is.
So, and somehow they don't look fake the way a color HDR does.
Because the colors haven't gone funny. Because there ain't no colors there.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that tends to get most screwy on an HDR is the color. And if you just take that out of the equation, you tend not to have the same problem of HDRs looking wrong. So that's a free little trick there.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I accidentally found it.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. So you need your layers. Two of them you may get for free. Mountains in the background can be another good way to get your background layer for free. But the hard one is your foreground. And if you imagine this landscape shot here with the castle in the background, there is easily a stretch of 400 yards where I could have stood to get that photograph. And depending on where along that 400-yard stretch I stood, the background would stay the same, but what would change would be my foreground.
So really paying attention to the foreground when you're doing it?
Yeah. There is a massive amount of places you could stand to get the same background, but each of those has a different foreground. And you just need to find the spot where you manage to get your layers. So a good thing to do, actually, is what's called framing a shot. And that's another reason I chose this example. So by sticking the tree close to the left, to the right edge, and having just its lower branches come in at the top, we've added a natural frame to the image on two sides. And that immediately helps to give the image depth. So if you just find a tree and get its trunk and some of its branches in on two sides, that's your nice foreground straight away. That is something interesting and it gives depth.
I have figured that one out. I've noticed, like, looking down into a valley, if you've got some branches near you that you can get into the frame, that always helps. Sometimes doing one at each diagonal might help.
Yeah. Yeah. That's called natural framing, and that is a form of foreground, and that gives you your sense of depth, and then you're in business. Something else, of course, something simple like rocks, flowers. Or you can get a little more, you know, rocks, flowers, fences, I think you've mentioned already. If you're out and about in the countryside, those little steps they have for getting over fences for walkers, stiles, we call them. I'm not sure what you guys call them.
I don't think we have those.
Ah, okay. They can work well. Or you can just say, I'm not going to find something that's exceptional. I'm just going to emphasize something. So texture in the foreground. Simply getting down to within about a foot of the ground means that the whole texture of the ground becomes available to you. Imagine a freshly mowed lawn with nice lines running up and down parallel to each other. Get down low to that, you get double sense of depth because you have the texture of the grass, but also the fact that you have parallel lines getting smaller. That adds to the illusion of depth because you're off to a vanishing point there. Right. So you win twice if you do that. Or it's autumn time, you can have some leaves on the ground. They're interesting. So you get down low so that you get the leaves, then your midground and your background, that works. So you can really be quite experimental with it, and even in fact something as simple as shadows. If there's a cool shape of a shadow, that can work as well as a foreground as anything else can. So I have three examples: the one we talked about, the black and white one with leaves in autumn, and then one taken in late in autumn when it's nearly winter, so that the trees behind me had lost all of their leaves, and you get the crisscross of branches cast as a shadow, and just use that as a foreground.
You know, Bart, you went over those kind of quickly, but you guys really do need to look at all these photographs. As hopefully you've been looking along as he's been talking, but the one with the leaves in the foreground, he's obviously very, very low to the ground, so it's a lot of foreground with these leaves on it, and it is amazing at drawing your eye to the castle or university or whatever that is in the background.
That's the building you'll be sleeping in, by the way.
Yay! I know, it's going to blow us
pretty
away.
Beautiful.
It's very, very cool. And then that draws your eye up to this really dark, rumbling, cloudy sky up above. But the sun is right on the university. It's just, I would have never thought to get close to the ground to add foreground to get a better shot of the castle, of the university. That's really neat.
Yeah, I got very wet legs because the ground was soaking.
Well, worth it for us.
The other thing, of course, is that you can use light to your advantage. If you have lots of clouds, you tend to have light moving. So in this case, when I got there, the light was at my feet and the building was in shade and I could just see the shadow moving. So I said, if I wait 30 seconds, I'm going to be in shade and the building's going to be in light. And I just waited. And then the moment the sunlight lit up the building, click. So that, again, it does help your sense of depth, because again, you have shadow going on as well as the leaves in the foreground. So there's, you know, shadows can be really quite fun to play with.
You know, I really feel like we're at a disadvantage here.
Oh.
Shadows, you know.
Well, you have trees and you have sun. That's got to make shadows.
We don't have a lot of trees. There are trees. And we do get clouds, but we tend to more towards where I live anyway, down near the beach, we tend towards this just overall haze, which makes there be no sun, no shade, no shadows. You get nothing. You just basically, and it's kind of even annoying to look at outside. Right now it's like that. The sky is white. But it's not cloudy.
If you can't get a cloud in the sky, you can actually use a setting sun as your third layer very well, too.
Yeah, our sunsets aren't even interesting here because there aren't a lot of
clouds.
Yeah, sunrise is actually fairly pretty. I've seen that twice or three times.
The sunrise is when it comes out of the sea, isn't it, on your seaboard?
No. Sunset is in the sea.
You should be able to do something with sunset.
Yeah.
Pop the sun on a rule of thirds corner.
And then have your landscape. I'm not saying it's never good, but well, no, the landscape is always just sand.
Stick a sandcastle in the front.
There you go. Look at you thinking. Or a shovel.
or a shovel in a bucket, and, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Bring props.
Absolutely.
Actually, we do have some nice little lifeguard towers that are fun to shoot around.
There you go. They're perfect to use as an interesting subject.
Yeah.
You're real Baywatch looking stuff there.
So I noticed with the shadows, the one that you did with the shadows as a foreground, they also do a diagonal draw, and almost a vanishing point, actually.
Yeah, those shadows just worked out really cool. I really love those shadows.
Yeah. Well, any more tips?
We're nearly done because I know we're running long on time. But if you can't get layers, so the other thing we've already mentioned is get a vanishing point. So if you have a bunch of parallel lines heading off into infinity, without any need for layers, they will give you your sense of depth. So the photograph we have to illustrate that is...
Shockingly.
It's shockingly a train. So you have three parallel elements. So you have... In the middle is the canal, which is a long straight canal. On the left of the canal is a long footpath with trees running along it. So you have this straight line of trees. Then on the other side of the canal, you have a straight railway line with a straight train running along it. And the whole lot of them are running off into the distance to a vanishing point. And where's the vanishing point in that picture?
Oh, it's at one of the third cross points.
It's at one of the rule of thirds points. So you get extra punch if you can make your vanishing point sit on one of those four points.
Oh. And the train has room to look into.
And the train has room to look in. And move and look. And the driver has room to look, because you can see his little head there.
Now, is every photograph you take, follow all of these and look perfect like this?
Well, no, they don't all follow them all, because
there are,
as
no
I
rules.
Say, there isn't rule of thirds in them all. There isn't. They all follow some of these rules. They all follow a subset of the rules, but they're all just guidelines. So you don't need to get everything in every shot, because you just never get a photograph. If you had to have perfect rule of thirds and perfect layers and perfect vanishing points, you'd have like
and
two
diagonals.
Photographs left in the world. And diagonals. I mean, there'd be nothing left.
Talk about burning your photos.
Yeah, exactly. There'd be nothing left. So these are just things to help make a less interesting scene more interesting, and to really capture the sense that, you know, when you were there, it felt beautiful. So you want your photograph to feel beautiful too.
These are excellent tips. I've been flipping through Flickr while I was talking to you, and then looking at the ones that really drew my eye and trying to see which one of the guidelines they might have followed. And it I can definitely see what you're saying.
Yeah, they'll all have some elements of these things. Then if you can't get a long straight line, which is obviously your best bet if you want to get a sense of perspective, a little winding path can do the world of good too. So I think the last example that we look at there is just a gently winding footpath.
Yeah.
So its texture is interesting, and then your eye sort of naturally wants to follow it because it's a path. And what do? You follow paths. And that brings you in and then sends you up to the little boathouse and stuff.
Really cool. Well, Bart, I love this. I'm going to bookmark this and keep it in mind when I go take pictures and just think, try to go back and review these and use this as a guideline. I really enjoyed this. This was, and the only number in here was 1/3.
Yeah, that's the only number. The only bit of mass is chopping something in 3.
Well,
and actually, aperture, if you hold down the command key while you're moving your crop in aperture, it'll draw a rule of thirds grid.
Oh, it will. The command key?
You have to hold down the command key.
Oh, I did not know.
So hold down the command key and then click and drag, and then you will see the grid, the rule of thirds grid as you're dragging.
Oh, cool. All right.
Well, iPhoto does it automatically, actually. So if you're editing an iPhoto, you just get the grid for free.
Oh, maybe that's why Lindsay's photos are good. She does it in iPhoto. All right, Bart. Well, I better cut you off here. We've been going on a long time. Looks like I think we're still on for next week looking okay.
Business as usual next week.
Sounds good. Getting wonderfully
close to you coming over here.
Yay! Can't wait.
And what we'll do next week, because we're going to do it this week, but we've totally run out of time, is next week we'll go through the details of the Maynooth tweet up.
Okay.
For all of our Irish people. He'll want to meet us in a few weeks from now.
Sounds good. I'm really excited. I heard Pat Mon is out of the hospital and he's going to be there, so it's going to be fun. And the Matter Hat is going to be there.
Yeah, Brian, I'm sure the MacRack lads will be there. I'll be very cranky if the MacRack lads aren't there.
Oh, definitely. By the way, the date is August 28th, so mark your calendars.
I thought the 28th was the day you landed rather than the day of the tweet-up.
No, it's the 28th. We land on the 27th.
Gee.
I'm looking at my calendar.
There you go. Yeah, look at you being right again.
I didn't guess it. I looked at the calendar.
Oh.
All right.
So there we go. That's the date. Yeah, we'll talk about it next week. We'll get some details together.
Sounds good.
Okay. Till next time, happy computing.
Well, I hope you guys all had a good time this week. We had a blast in the live show. If you'd like to join us in there, see how the sausage gets made, head on over to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Or just subscribe to the NoCillaCast calendar I told you about so you'll always know the time in your own time zone. You don't have to listen to me making it up each week. You can chat away with all of the NoCilla castaways, yell at me to save, mock me when I stumble over words, lots of good, clean family entertainment. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet, and be sure to send in your dumb questions, comments, suggestions, and reviews to allison@podfeet.com. And don't forget to get stuff ready for Katie for the end of August when she's got to do the show all by herself. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.